Hello, welcome to this week's edition of the Weekly Report. Today is May 29th, 2013. My name is Megan Beats of the LaRouche PAC Scientific Research Team. I'm joined today by Ben Denniston, also of the Scientific Research Team, and Lyndon LaRouche. So I think, Ben, you're going to start us off.
Yeah, I kind of want to open with an update on just some of our activity going on in the solar system the past couple weeks. It'd be a good introduction to some of the activity we're going to get into. But starting with, actually, this Friday, there's going to be a notable event, which is going to be a flyby of a rather large asteroid. This Friday, the 31st, there's going to be about a 1 mile in diameter asteroid that's going to pass about 15 times the distance from the Earth to the Moon. So it's in terms of the scale of the solar system, a relatively nearby pass. And in terms of bodies this big, I mean, this is a large object. We don't get these things coming by this closely very often. So, we're safe on this path. There's not a threat of impact. But it's a good reminder of the fact you do have these things floating around the territory. And it would be a good opportunity to get better observations on the object, too, because it's going to be passing close enough that we can actually not only observe it with telescopes, but we can actually send signals to it from the Earth. We can actually beam it with radio signals, which will bounce back and give us an image of the structure of it, how fast it's rotating, if it's more spherical or more irregularly shaped. So we actually get a lot of good information you actually can't get with telescopes unless it comes really, really close. But with these radio beams, if it comes close enough, you can get a good reading of a map of the object. So I'm sure we're going to get some interesting images, probably video footage of the object as it's coming by this Friday. But it's just a good reminder of what we're dealing with in the solar system. And mind you, this is one that is, again, about 1 mile across. So the one that hit over Russia earlier in February was like a speck compared to this one. That was like 15 or 20 meters across. This one's 1 mile across. So this is the scale where if one were to impact this big, it would have global ramifications. So a very significant size object. Again, it's not going to hit this time, but it'll give us a good show and a good reminder for what we're dealing with these objects. Now, also at the same time, the past 2 weeks have seen a pretty interesting increase in both solar activity and earthquake activity. And we had, for example, two geomagnetic storms over the past week where the Earth's magnetic field was fluctuating intensely as a function of being impacted by solar activity. And we also had a number of very large flares, solar flares coming off the sun, two of them being actually the third and fourth largest solar flares we've had this entire solar cycle. So for over 5 years, we had these are the third and fourth largest we've had of this entire solar cycle. And that comes on top of a good number of smaller solar flares, a good number of sunspots, some coronal mass ejections. So there's a lot of activity generally on the sun the last couple weeks. There was an increase compared to prior activity. Now, what was also interesting is we did have a notable increase in earthquake activity over the same period. The most recognized event was a very large earthquake off the coast of Russia near Kamchatka on the Pacific coast, which was very, very deep. It was away from any populated areas, so it didn't cause any damage. But this was the largest quake we've had in over a year and was associated with, it was an 8.3, and it was associated with a number of other smaller and medium-sized quakes in the area and around the globe. So you did have a general, for example, the last 2 weeks, this last 2-week period, you've had the same amount of decent-sized earthquakes as you had the previous 5 weeks before that. So definitely a peak of activity. Now, this is obviously interesting. Unfortunately, the idea of trying to forecast earthquakes on a one-to-one correspondence with solar activity is notoriously hard. It's very hard to get a one-to-one correspondence where you try and predict exactly the earthquake effect from some solar activity. So there's been a lot of work trying to figure that out. Still a long way to go in the science, but what we definitely know is if you step back and look at the longer-term relationships, there's a lot of indications of some interconnection between the solar activity and the activity on Earth. And I want to just highlight one study that indicates that, which should give us a warning about what we're going into. This was a Japanese study that was done analyzing the last four solar cycles. So the sun has these 11-year cycles of increase and decrease in solar activity, sunspots, flares, these types of things. And so you have this periodic 11-year increase, decrease of solar activity. So what this team in Japan did was they broke the solar cycle into two halves. They took the what they called the ascending half and the maximum, and then the descending half and the minimum. So they looked at the one solar cycle, and they looked at the period of when the solar activity is increasing up to where it peaks, and that's one half of the solar cycle. And then they looked at the period when the solar cycle is decreasing and reaches a bottom, and that's the second half of the solar cycle. And so what they did was then they took a database of all the major earthquakes over these four solar cycles, so almost 50 years, and they compared the occurrence of earthquakes as whether they happen on this ascending and maximum half versus descending and minimum half. And as you can see in their graph distribution, you get consistently a higher likelihood of earthquakes during the descending period of the solar cycle and the minimum of the solar cycle. For earthquakes ranging from 5 to 5.9, it's about a 40% to 60% division. 40% of those earthquakes occurred during the ascending and maximum half of the cycle. 60% occurred during the descending and minimum, so a significant difference. But that difference gets even bigger as you look at larger and larger earthquakes. For ranges from 6 to 6.9, you can see it's closer to more of a 38-62% division. You get to even larger quakes, 7 to 7.9, you're looking at about 35-65 division. And then for the really big earthquakes, 8.0 and above, you get almost an 80% to 20% division, where 80% of these earthquakes over the past almost 50 years have occurred on this particular half of the solar cycle. So if you look at the broader picture, there's definitely, and this is one study, there's other studies. So whereas trying to do a one-to-one prediction of particular solar activity predicting the exact effect on Earth the next day or the next week is shown to be very difficult. But there's definitely indications that there's some relationships that we need to understand. And this would be the time to focus on that, because currently, this is where we are on our current solar cycle. We've been, since late 2009, 2010, we've been increasing in solar activity. Now it's looking like we're about at the peak. We've probably rounded the peak. We're near the peak of solar activity. We had a lot, last 2 weeks, as I mentioned, were intense activity. But it's looking like over the coming years, we're going to start to see the decline and going down towards the minimum. So this would be the period in which we'd want to really begin to take seriously earthquake forecasting operations and begin to really take seriously what the relationship is within the whole system, the whole solar system. And this is becoming a practical matter, because that 8.3 we saw off of Russia is probably just the beginning of some increased activity over the coming years. And you know, if you look at the death count of earthquakes the past decade, it's remarkable how many lives have been lost. And we have the capability to better understand this. So this is a real call to better understand this relationship of solar activity and earthquake activity. But I want to just open with those points just to kind of give a sense of some current activity. You have this asteroid flyby. You got a lot of other flybys occurring. This one's particularly big. You have this increased solar activity. But I think it just forces a more general question that we've been discussing, which is mankind coming to move out into the solar system as a really creative force in the solar system, which, as we've emphasized, doesn't mean where you put yourself biologically. It's not where we send people physically. It's more a question of what's the extent of the reach of the power of the human mind as a creative force throughout the whole solar system. But what I wanted to get into is that that raises immediately some very principled questions that need to be placed up front. As soon as you're talking about mankind entering the solar system as a creative force, you're immediately forced to reckon with increases of orders of magnitude of activity. Anything that we're used to dealing with on Earth jumps many fold as soon as you just try and do basic processes in the solar system. You know, a good example being speeds. You know, typical speeds in the solar system are unheard of compared to on Earth. Even speeds of bullets shot out of rifles is small compared to the speeds you're dealing with in the solar system. Even just in orbit, orbiting the Earth, one bolt or one screw, you know, lost off of a satellite or something could take out a whole satellite because the speeds are so fast. You know, you're not worried about getting hit with a bolt on Earth and it ruining your day, right? I mean, it's a small little thing, and what's that going to do? But if you put it at the speeds of orbital speeds, one little bolt, one screw, one, you know, something the size of this cup, tiny object can just devastate a large satellite. Just because the speeds are so fast, the impact has so much energy. The space station is threatened with these objects, for example. Space debris threatening astronauts in the space station because you got this junk floating around. And the only thing they can do now with the space station is move it out of the way. So if you have like a, you know, something the size of a cup coming at the space station, they have to literally move the whole space station to ensure it doesn't hit. And that's the best defense we have right now. But that's just, you know, this is the kind of stuff we're dealing with. But again, these asteroid speeds, the asteroid that hit over Russia, you know, the reason why the explosion was so big because the speeds are so fast, you know, 17,000 miles per hour. You know, they don't even talk about miles per hour in the solar system. They talk about miles per second, kilometers per second. So you're just automatically dealing with these vast speeds. You're also dealing with huge distances. You know, take the Earth-Mars relationship. You know, on Earth, you might talk about thousands of miles as long distances, kind of the max you would discuss in terms of dealing with in any processes on Earth. As soon as you get into the solar system and you look at the Earth-Mars relationship, you're immediately talking about many tens of millions of miles in terms of distances you have to deal with. And that, you know, poses all kinds of challenges for time considerations, because now the speed of light is no longer instantaneous. You know, communicating with Mars can take anywhere from 3 to 20 minutes just to get one signal there, even with speed of light communications. And it's also worth noting that because the distances are so vast, you have the real challenge with the energy required to transmit signals. Like, for example, we don't have any video footage from Mars, from the Curiosity rover. We get a lot of good images, a lot of good pictures, but we don't have any video. I've never seen any video. And there's a good reason for that. It's because the signal dissipates and weakens because it has to travel so far that we actually can't send a high rate of information back and forth. So we're actually very limited in the rate of communication from here to Mars. And if we were going to really ramp up our ability to control these robotic apparatuses on Mars and around asteroids and on the moon, we need to make great advances in our energy density of communication systems. The density, the shorter wavelength, higher concentration of communication signals would be a huge breakthrough in allowing real higher bandwidth, higher data processing for controlling these robotic instruments and getting all the scientific information back. But I think what is really interesting, though, and I think what we'd like to get into is some of the discussions that, so these are the, you know, as soon as you think about moving into the solar system, you're challenged in all these levels where everything you're used to dealing with on Earth, it leaps by orders of magnitude. But it goes to a much more fundamental level, because not only are these different metrics we're used to increasing by orders of magnitude, but the metrics themselves break down. As soon as you start to really think about dealing with the solar system, as a solar system, you're forced to confront the fact that space, time, matter as independent objects don't actually exist as independent things. as soon as you begin to deal with processes of the solar system, you're forced to reckon with the fact that the only reason we thought these were independent things or metrics we could use by themselves was because of a bias we brought into it with our sense perceptual apparatus. We tend to make a division between space and time, distance and time, for example. We tend to make a distinction between things we think of as material, matter, you know, hard physical objects, and things that are immaterial, like light waves, energy. We tend to make these distinctions. And much all of science has been built around, you know, up to the recent period, has been built around these as fundamental distinctions. But as soon as you go into space, these are forced to break down. You know, you have Einstein's famous case of Mercury, right? You have Einstein's famous case of the demonstration of relativity with the case of Mercury, where for, you know, I think since the 1860s, they couldn't figure out why Mercury was moving the way it was. They had this anomaly in Mercury's motion that they couldn't account for. And it wasn't until Einstein came along and proved that space and time are actually not independent entities, and that distance actually changes as a function of time, and time actually changes as a function of distance. When you get to these types of speeds and changes of speeds you're dealing with in the solar system, distance is no longer an absolute metric. It depends upon your action, your relative observations. And to actually understand Mercury's orbit, you actually had to begin to take in these relativistic effects, where space and time had to be treated as functions of one process. They could no longer be independent things. You know, if you're dealing with even the heart of our solar system, the core of it, the sun, depends upon fusion processes. Well, what are fusion processes? That's, you know, bounded by, again, by Einstein's famous work, now with his E equals mc squared, where matter and energy can no longer be considered as separate things. What we had thought of as hard material and immaterial energy phenomena are actually part of the same thing somehow. You actually have to strip down your assumption that these were ever even separate phenomena. So if you take something like fusion propulsion throughout the solar system, something we want to get into in the coming generations, if we're actually going to be able to move mankind efficiently throughout the solar system, you know, we'll have to do a lot of prep work with robotic instrumentation, with lunar development, with a lot of robotic and automated systems. And if we ever want to really move mankind around, it's going to require to moving towards the energy flux density levels of fusion propulsion systems. But you're forced immediately, if you're dealing with fusion propulsion, you're dealing with the elimination, you're forced to reckon with the fact that you're eliminating all these preconceived assumptions about space, about time, about matter. And it's just going to be fundamentally true that if mankind's going to exist and be a creative force in the solar system as a whole, it is going to require not just a revolution in a scalar increase in how we deal with these different phenomena, these different metrics, but it requires something much more fundamental, which, you know, Lynn, you've been unique in emphasizing, which is ridding this idea that sense perception has any inherent value in measuring and understanding the solar system, that we're bringing, as long as we continue to rely on sense perception, we're bringing an artificial bias into the discussion. And the way that we can actually understand these things is not through sense perception, but as typified by Einstein, through a unique creative capability of the human mind as a unique creative force in the universe, which is not a force that's associated with sense perception or your biology, but it's a fundamentally different capability. And moving into the solar system, you know, these are just some examples, but moving into the solar system is going to require a revolution in understanding and tapping that potential, and really ridding these preconceived assumptions that have been, frankly, holding science and society back.
Precisely.
You know, I think it's worth putting it to that level, that it's going to be, it's not just a question of taking our current capabilities and increasing them in some kind of scalar fashion, but it's going to require a fundamental revolution in how we even think about the assumptions that govern the way we think about these things.
Right. Well, the problem here is that we've got two aspects of this thing. One aspect is what you're talking about, these effects. Mm-hmm. Then you find out the effects are, in a sense, anomalous, because you cannot derive these effects from simple systems. But then you get into the area of metaphor, mm-hmm. and you begin to get it with Nicholas of Cusa, but that's not explained. The Doctrina Gratia is clear. But then with Kepler, you have something much more interesting. Mm-hmm. Kepler actually introduces a new way of thinking about the universe. When it's conclusive. And with the way we see this, we deal with this, the idea of metaphor, you deal with this. Kepler was the first to really deal with this thing in terms of his principle of metaphor. Then others came along, and we find that in classical artistic composition, you find the same kind of thing. You have reversal. You think that you have a physical effect, and you find the physical effect is not true. There's something else that's true. This, of course, is Kepler did most mm-hmm. of all. He made this clear on the conception of space and time. And then we have the other case, you get another art to go at, classic artistic composition. This has a much more specific and clear meaning of what this is all about. For example, let's take Henry V, King Henry V, Shakespeare. What does he do? He introduces a new concept into the drama. And he does it emphatically in King Henry V. He does it more subtly, actually, in the later acts of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. Now you get into music. You get into classical drama. And the same thing. You find that the if you're trying to interpret music from an effect, it doesn't work. It works in a completely opposite way. Mm-hmm. If you try dealing with the idea of metaphor, the essential principle is that what people think are the effects, which are primary, are absolutely only side effects,
right.
Which is what was done by Kepler precisely on this issue. And so this area is also for drama. It's significant for Shakespeare on this point. That makes the point with Shakespeare on Henry V. Mm-hmm. Now everything then you say, well, look, you've got two things going here, which Shakespeare is doing. On the one side, he's telling you the fairy stories. Hmm? Then he's saying the opposite's true. It's the same kind of thing. Then you get into great classical drama, all classical drama, music, the same thing. The substance is not what you think is the physical effect. It's the opposite. If you say sense perception, that is not what the experience is. It's the opposite. That's what Kepler defined in terms of the whole of the system, the discovery of the principle of the solar system. Mm-hmm. And I hate to go into detail here because there's a lot of background that has to go into it. But we need that now, because people are fooled because they believe that sense perception is truth, and sense perception is not truth. For example, all musical composition. How can you define that? You can't define it the way people define it. It has an indirect effect, just like the case of Henry V is crucial, because it demonstrates very conveniently what the problem is. Shakespeare came along and you did this thing with Henry V, and it was something absolutely new, and turns everything upside down, because chorus is true and the act is not. And this is true in all classical drama. All classical music, if it's competent, is based on that. The competent performance of classical music, it depends upon that principle. You know, it's a physical principle. It's a universal physical principle. We think that sense perception and our experience in sense perception is truth, but it's not. It's a shadow. It's a shadow cast by that which is true. Just like the actors in chorus mm-hmm. speak the truth. The players playing the part as on stage are lying. And that's the way you have to understand it. That's the irony. That's what the dramatic irony really is in classical dramatic irony. And the same thing is true in physical science. And I'm doing this paper. I didn't want to go into the detail of it because it should be the finished work, which goes through the whole thing. But the essential points are here on this. And you find that, you know, just think about the idea. What do you mean about the meaning of a classical artistic work, say in music? What does that mean? Is that real? Not really. It's because you're trying to reduce it to objects. And it's not objects. It's a process in the universe. It's just like, how is it that the in chorus in Shakespeare, how is it that the chorus is just spoken and described? And that's the truth. Because what it's showing, always demonstrating, is that which is that, is always determining what's going to happen. So how can you, it's the same thing in music. If you try to interpret music on the basis of the sound as such, it's the organization of the process that you want to get. And this is where science fails often. And when you're going into space, that's what you have to deal with. You're going to use sense perception. You're going to use sense perception to define how the universe is organized. You can't do that. It's not done. You can fake it. So the issue is always to get the human is opposite. The truth is opposite to what people think is the objective truth. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is fun, and I think that some of us can follow what I'm doing with this and have some fun with it. It is what has to be done. And you just think of Shakespeare, then you think of the great dramatic works generally. And then you think of music. Mm-hmm. How can you tie values to musical composition? How can you find values to them as physical values, like objects, measuring them? Mm. What is this subtleness that makes the difference between the true composition and the failure? So you have to invert the thing. That what you're seeing is the shadow. You're calling the shadow real, and you're missing reality. And this is, I'm putting this on the lead of my work on this stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a very simple thing, in a sense. What you believe is sense perception is not truth. It's a shadow. It's an ontological shadow. And what you think is true is actually only mere shadow. It is the chorus in Henry V that is the truth. That's what the chorus does. It tells you that this drama is all crap.
There's the counterpoint. It's the chorus in Henry V and then the following unfolding of the scenes, which are merely the shadows. Yeah. And it's the setup of the mind with the monologues of chorus and then the playing out of something which now you have in your mind as having a dual, kind of a dual reality, what chorus told you and what you're seeing. And it's the tension between the two of those things. And that's not something which exists in any of the literal objects.
You can take that in music generally.
Absolutely. You get the same thing. Furtwängler discusses the errors in the two schools of performance. The first school of performance is the play exactly what's written on the page. Play me the literal notes with precision and timing, precision and technique, perfect pitches. And he says, this is absolutely wrong. This is dead. And then the other similarly failed school of performance and interpretation is that, well, there is no truth. It's whatever I want. It's whatever feeling state I can create in the immediate effect of my performance. Mm. And his point is that both are wrong. Both are absolutely wrong. It's only in the recreation of the creative act of the original composer that you can possibly ever give correct so-called values to the notes. And I think that expresses what you're bringing about in this inversion, that the notes as such are only a physical effect. They're sort of an afterthought.
Yeah. Well, that's what I think we have to do in this organization, is to emphasize precisely that. Because if you're looking for truth, why are you looking in the garbage pail? which is what you're generally looking at. Why do you treat, Liszt as a composer? He doesn't compose anything. He decomposes things.
Yes, sir. Huh?
And even worse, of course, is the real monster. And they don't compose anything. They decompose.
And then they replace the idea with program music. They replace an actual poetic conception and a poetic effect with a description in the program of what you're supposed to be feeling at every point in the piece.
A very good composer and performer, especially a performer, made an experiment in which he trimmed out certain things in the drama. And it just didn't work. Because what he did, he eliminated the factor in music, which corresponds to what the factor is in music, in composition. Hmm. That the elements that you include have to be the equivalent of the chorus aspect, which indicate to you and indicate to everyone what this has to be to get this effect. And that's where this very distinguished performer, which usually I would say is very brilliant, goofed things up when he tried to do a dramatic treatment. And it just was a complete flop. And what he did is he pulled these things out to make things more literal. He took out the parts, the elements, which were of the composition, which he to have more a literal composition, a truthfully literal composition. And he missed the point. He moved to Britain, maybe that why that happened. But this is the issue. The fact is that mankind is enslaved by a society which forces them to see a direct opposite of the truth in the performance or in the idea. And this is true in physical science, but it's a lot of fun because the reason why it is a lot of fun is a subjective question. When you can bring in the subjective aspect of composition, then you are actually indicating what is wrong with the so-called literal kind of composition. If you're trying to make the meaning located in the literal intention of the things that move, wiggle, and so forth,
then you're
destroying your ability to communicate. And you're failing to see exactly what Shakespeare did with Henry V, which is, this was the great revolution. It was a great revolution in composition by Shakespeare. And Henry V was the best exposition of this. The other things, the play that were earlier plays, all had an attempt to do that. And with the actors performing properly and directors doing properly, you could get the effect. But he, at that point, with Henry V, he said, I'm going to have to make this work on its own. And what he did is he put the parts which are in there. And that is what makes it work. It's the chorus. Chorus is the principle. And if you take the chorus principle of Shakespeare in terms of Henry V, and you look at drama generally, it's all there. Schiller's there as well.
And also the musical composers. I mean, it's no coincidence that at the time of Mozart that you had the translations of Shakespeare beginning into German. You had the Schumanns and Brahms were reading Shakespeare plays together. And I think it's no coincidence that you had the breakthrough in a compositional principle, which Shakespeare expresses, which is then picked up and developed in a completely intense way in this classical school in musical composition. It's the same principle.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And this is particularly what some people treat on the part of Mozart as his florid things were not that at all. They were actually quite the contrary. It was the flavor, so-called, was the thing that made the drama. But this is true in all science. When we rely upon sense perception per se, and try to make it mechanical in any respect, and adduce things from a mechanical viewpoint, mankind is not speaking. And this goes into physics, the physical question, thoroughly. We have to realize that physical science, the way it is taught, makes the same mistake of not seeing the chorus principle.
Yeah, because there's only one irreducible source of mankind have access to these principles. And if you don't put the focus on that unique source, that unique capability, which doesn't derive from any of these sense perceptual, if you don't make that an, as you did, I find it, you do it a lot, you've done it a lot, I still find it very provocative that you take, you know, these, what most people would talk about as different subjects, the work of Kepler, people would even divide Kepler from Kuza, which is wrong, but the work of Shakespeare, the work of Bach, but finding what is the convergence of these different, what is actually unifying these different, supposedly different areas of study, and make that a conscious object of contemplation, of investigation.
Well, it's a very simple way of, in terms of locating, the vital point. Is the difference between an animal and a human being, or the human mind? That's the difference. We use the human mind, and when we use the human mind, we have a completely different result. The animal cannot do that. Mm-hmm. Only the human being properly can do it. So what people are doing is they're functioning as animals. The same way they say, you can't know the future. Mm-hmm. Same problem. You can't know the future. And that's what, you only go so far, and beyond that you're just guessing. Well, I know that's false. And other people know that's false.
You've demonstrated that's false.
Yeah. Well, sure. That's why I do forecasting. Yeah. But that's not me knowing forecasting. Me is doing what is simply normal human thinking, uh-huh. as opposed to the stripped off thinking with imitation human thinking. It's actually what it is. Uh-huh. I mean, just look at the Shakespeare, for me, the case of Henry VIII, is a real revelation, because it makes clear something which Kuza did earlier, and it also goes directly to Kepler. Kepler is the key to this thing. Kepler's conception. Mm-hmm. That's what it is.
Yeah, on the issue of what Kepler did, I was just thinking about it as we're talking, that when Kepler discovers that the motions of the solar system are expressing the notes of the musical scale that human beings had been using in their poetry and song for as far, you know, long, far back as we know. When he made that discovery, it completely blew out of the water any kind of reductionist method, any kind of idea that you know the universe by measurement with your senses. Yeah. Because the ratios of the motions which were expressing musical proportions were not the literal proportions which could have been measured by any kind of vibrating string or any kind of sense perceptual measurement. In fact, if you look at the literature now which talks about Kepler's discovery, if they even talk about this aspect of his discovery, they say, well, you know, the musical harmonies that Kepler finally discovered in the solar system, they're not perfect, they're not exactly the musical harmonies of the scales. They're not the perfect proportions, 2 to 3, 4 to 5, 1 to 2. They're a little bit off, but, you know, who can blame him? It's an attractive idea. But what are they leaving out? I mean, you look at what Kepler actually did. There were errors. The actual proportions of the motions of the heavens don't express the literal sense perceptible scale. What they express are values that they have to take up because they're expressing a unified composition of the sun or a unified action of the sun. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, if you look at Kepler's work, is he develops the work up to the point where you see that there's an indication of musical harmonies. And then he puts all of the sense perceptual measurements away. And he starts again, and he recreates the motions of the solar system as if he were God, or as if he were the creator. Yeah. And he literally recreates the system as a human creation. And from there determines what the physical expression of the motions would be. And so in my mind, he's recaptured or recreated the solar system as a human creation.
Well, would you trust anybody who didn't do that?
It wouldn't take you so far.
That's it. The point is that what is done is often a fraud, but it's based on a presumption which is not true and it was never proven. But the point is, the key thing is, what's wrong with mankind? What is evil? Evil is very simple. You take a human being and you treat them as an animal, not a human being.
Well, in that, in the harmony of the world, I always loved Kepler's attack on Aristotle, where he says Aristotle should be thrown out of Christianity. He literally says Aristotle should not be acceptable in the Christian religion because of his blank slate conception.
Exactly.
Because his conception of the human soul is just a blank slate that sense perceptual readings can just write anything on, and there's no creative capability in the individual in Aristotle's doctrine.
The crisis of the slave, of the human slave. The human slave is told not to be human. That's what you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's wrong with this society, is it accepts values which are arbitrary values, in fact. There's the entire system is based on that.
And freedom in the most fundamental sense, not freedom the way people mostly think about it. They think about, what am I allowed to do, this thing or that thing, but they're denied access to the most fundamental part about being human.
Take the case of so-called modern painting.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Same thing. Garbage. Why is it garbage? Because they don't have the spirit to do what they should do. Mm-hmm. So they make garbage to show their independence. Mm-hmm. And it gets you to interpret what you see as painted. But this goes much deeper, but I what I'm doing with this is concentrating on this rather more simple exposition of the thing.
Mm-hmm.
It goes much further. But it's obvious that unless we do this, we do not directly attack the problem. And my concern is to attack the problem. And you can do this with musical composition beautifully, because we have in musical composition, we have contrasts between the classical and the romantic, so-called. And that is clear. And the behavior of the people, I mean, if you look at, well, but that's the same, it's the same thing. So when we think with our mind, we find we do not accept sense perception as a standard.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't work. It can't work. But what you have is a so-called practical person, the sense perception deranged person, do not know what reality is.
Mm-hmm.
They know, they adopt behavior which is imposed upon them, and they always use the objective, so-called objective experience. And where the human experience is always subjective.
Mm.
It is never objective. It can't be. Because the objective experience, you mean stupid people. They don't know how to think, therefore they invent things which make no sense, but they agree to like them, agree to approve them. And that's why they brought this. I didn't bring it in here to attend for this event.
Right.
But I thought, you know, it illustrates what the point is I'm concerning with.
Maybe I can raise one thing that you, just in glancing over your writing before the show, one thing I think we haven't touched on explicitly yet today, but which I think is important, is the social aspect of all of this. And you bring it up in your writing as a place where we could possibly find the answer to this so-called paradox between the mind and the brain, which is this issue we're discussing of the sense perception, the animal biological aspect of processes, which, you know, and that which is where people falsely locate the human mind. And then you have the actual processes of the human mind, and you have the challenge that man faces of actually inducing noetic processes which don't yet exist.
Well, that's exactly it. That's this comes up and was forced on me on the question of space exploration. Because in what we have in the evolution of systems, living systems, you actually have states which do not correspond to any a priori system specifications of behavior. They don't.
Hmm.
So there you say, wait a minute, what about this brain thing? Well, the brain is not an independent agency. The brain is a simple biological agency, but what happens? The brain is able to change itself, to change the mind. And that's the difference. You can observe the planets, but you can't explain why they would move. But you get Kepler comes along, and Kepler treats it as such, and he has a solution. But the other blokes have no idea what this is. They couldn't recreate it. They couldn't explain it. They couldn't understand it. And you say, well, then the sense perception side is defective. It's something you use, but it is not independently reliable. Whereas the mind, which discovers individual principles of behavior as opposed to mechanics, works. Mm-hmm. And that's what the point is. That the human mind is what you want to rely on, not the human brain. And all these questions, you know, various people dealt with this at, you know, end of the 19th century.
Right.
But that's where it is. It's the mind is really the superior agency specific to humanity, whereas anything else is simply animals, mm-hmm. or worse. Rocks.
The challenge is to make that a self-conscious object of pursuit.
Imagine the destruction that is done by the presuming that kind of experience is truth for human beings. Mm-hmm. What are you doing? You were saying the brain. Mm-hmm. You mean you intend to destroy the mind, right? Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what the effect is.
I don't think we have to imagine that kind of effect. I think we see it.
Oh, that's the person cannot see the future. They can't see the future because they are tied to what they think is the brain function. It's a deductive approach. Assume it's fixed. All you can do is discover what was already there. The idea of creating a new state, the idea of taking mankind, who has now escaped from the animal category. And, you know, it's an absolute evolution. They break. Man is not an animal. Then you try to impose the animal behavior as by animal standards, and what do? You distort the mind, the human mind. And the person who is incapable of foreseeing what the future is, because they're always looking at this post hoc. But this is my little baby, having fun with this.
And you see that with even leaders, so-called leaders of society, that making decisions that are just marching the world towards total breakdown, total collapse, when they should be fully capable of seeing the future, as you're saying, seeing the implications of what they're doing, but they continue to do it.
An interesting phenomenon, warfare. Mm-hmm. Losing and winning warfare. Mm-hmm. It's another case of that. Mm. Frederick the Great. He had all the skills, the mental skills, of being a leader. He's just short of troops. Uh-huh. And he made a mistake. He relied on the British. That was his big mistake. Mm-hmm. And he recognized that. Oh, my big mistake. I made a big mistake. I went with the British. That was silly of me. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So we live in a society where the society is crippled by this reductionist approach to things. And that's what you've got to break through. And you have to deal with the fact that the noetic bosses is what you have to engage. And we have to do it. That's what we have to do. If we want to be effective in dealing with the crisis of mankind, we've got to deal with the noetic factor, because that's the only thing that will give you real truth.
And that's what the empire can't control.
Yeah, that's what I thought, you know, that you were doing in this direction. I thought it was a waste of you not to do that rather than other things that people would have you do. I just thought that was a big mistake.
Yeah, because this question of music is absolutely crucial.
Yeah.
And you can see how the empire had to try to, actually, if you look at the period of the 1890s through up until World War I, And then following, you had intensive political manipulation by the empire of the European powers for warfare. But you look at the period leading up to that, the whole 19th century, and you see that in order to be able to do that, they first had to attack the culture. They had to stop the kind of breakout of human creativity and the threat of having this power disseminate through the population that was expressed by the development of culture, particularly in Germany, but other places too.
That's the green problem. Mm-hmm. The greenies are always moving to destroy humanity. And if you're a green, the green policy is anti-human. Mm-hmm. It is bestial. So greenies are bestial people of a kind of species called the animal species, which tends to get wiped out because it precisely because it's bestial as opposed to human. And that's why the difficulty in politics is that difficulty. You're dealing with people who don't want to face the truth. They want a deductive approach or something they can, you know, fabricate and call it creative. But the human being is different. Animals become extinct unless human beings protect them. But the problem is that what we have today are people who are essentially animals in their standard of behavior. Then you have to impose behavior on them, synthetic behavior upon them, because their real nature as bestial people doesn't function too well. Mm-hmm. And the point is, what we have to do in society, obviously, it has to be a human commitment. And we have to look at things in actual human terms. I can use Nicholas Akuza, which is explicit. I can use Kepler, explicit. But when you get to drama, the classical drama, such as Shakespeare, and then you look at classical musical composition in the same terms, now you say, wait a minute, this is what humanity is. And what these guys are doing is inhuman. What they do is they then adopt a code dictated to them on behavior, and they, different kinds of behavioral systems, and they regard that as reality. And their cultural life, everything they do is tied into that sort of thing. And what happens is we get humanity is essentially crushed. It's crushed not necessarily out of existence, but it's crushed in terms of its right to express itself in society. Mm-hmm. And I think the few of us who have got some smell of this thing really have to do much more effort in concentrating on precisely those features, which are the important ones, and do the teaching and do the other things which all go with that. The switch from the so-called normal to the real. I'm sure we can do it. I think our frustrations in our own organization come largely as a result of that. They try to behave themselves as reductionists. And then they adopt false reductions, mm-hmm. which are just purely arbitrary reductions, and that makes things even worse. A dog will do better than a man who behaves that way. But I think we have to put an emphasis on exactly that.
Right.
And get people to concentrate and do what they can in trying to master this. And we get into discussion of it, it's things that you know in a sense, but you don't use properly. You know they're there. You try to adapt to whatever is acceptable or instructions or commonality. I've always despised that stuff. Well, no, it's true. It's not true. Huh? And then you get. What you get with Kepler, for example, is you get on top of Kuza, that you get with Kepler, you get a persistent, a driving force committed to get something done that's right. And you get the same thing with Shakespeare, particularly with that invention. And then you look at other great composers of drama and so forth. They all do the same thing. They fight against the pricks, which has two connotations.
All right. I think that's a good assignment. All right, so that'll do it for this week. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you soon.